The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is The Takeaway from Wednesday, October 26th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. A team called the Indians in a city where the oil industry began triumphs in Game 1 of the World Series.
The 2-2. Indians win Game 1.
At the same moment, the ruthless pressure of that energy expansion from the industry born in Cleveland takes on a team who don't just call themselves traditional Indians. Native tribes fight the Dakota Access Pipeline in ancestral lands of the Standing Rock Sioux. This hour, a long look at the troubles in Indian country where Native American history is on a collision course with a nation waking up to the ghosts of the past. It's been over 2 months now since protesters began demonstrating against the construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline, which members of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe say the pipeline would cut through its sacred ancestral lands. In the latest protests, 127 people were arrested on rioting charges, though protesters argue that their demonstrations have been peaceful. Police said they trespassed on private land and created illegal roadblocks on a highway. The Guardian is reporting that presidential candidate Donald Trump has sizable investments, close to $1 million, with the company building that pipeline, and that the CEO of the company, Kelsey Warren, has given more than $100,000 to the Trump campaign. Last night, Standing Rock resident and North Dakota congressional candidate Chase Iron Eyes addressed a crowd in a conference broadcast on Facebook Live.
Our fires have always burned. They've never gone out. But what we're seeing now is that the fires are burning hotter. We are rising as a people. We're not holding back to speak out on what our rights are and defending those rights.
Amy Sisk is a reporter with the Inside Energy Public Media Collaboration and Prairie Public Broadcasting. She says this pipeline controversy has overtaken the whole North Dakota oil boom story.
This has definitely cast a bit of a shadow over the oil industry here in North Dakota. For a long time, there was no way to get North Dakota crude to market other than to transport it via rail as this oil boom took off, about a decade ago. And so the state has really had to add on pipeline capacity to try to transport oil to market. The Dakota Access Pipeline would be the biggest pipeline project in the state. So the oil industry is quite concerned about the protests going on.
And why, if they were that concerned, did they omit consulting with the tribes, as is the chief charge of the protesters that you spent some time with over the weekend?
You know, that's a good question. It kind of depends who you asked what their take is on it. The oil industry, the oil company Energy Transfer Partners, and then the Army Corps of Engineers, which has to issue some of the permits for the pipeline, will tell you that, yes, they did consult with the tribe. The tribe, however, feels that consultation wasn't adequate, that they needed to have more of a say and more of an involvement in examining some of these sites where the pipeline is crossing.
And the chief problem is where that pipeline would go underneath the Missouri River, correct?
Yes. So the pipeline is slated to cross underneath the Missouri River here in North Dakota. But one of the other concerns that the tribe here has is that pipeline construction in the area is destroying sacred sites like burial grounds.
And the federal government is not of one mind about this. It appears the Obama administration supports the protesters, or at least supports a slowing down of the pipeline construction, while the tribe has asked the Justice Department to explicitly weigh in, while the district court has allowed the company to move.
Yes, there's been a lot of developments with regard to all of that. I think one of the most significant things that we've seen happen is that there's one final permit that the pipeline company is waiting on to actually build underneath the Missouri River, and that is an easement. The Army Corps of Engineers, along with the Justice Department and the Interior Department, has come out and effectively said, we're going to stop construction at the Missouri River and not grant that easement just yet, because we want to look back at all of the permitting decisions we make and before issuing that easement.
Meanwhile, some of the people you met over the weekend, and there were some 127 arrests, were talking as though they've been fighting a war with the Army Corps of Engineers for almost a century.
Yes. I mean, there's a long history of tribes fighting similar fights on their reservations all over the country, whether it's a pipeline going through, whether it has to do with a mine that, you know, has spilled into a river, toxic substances, you know, that's affecting a reservation, or, you know, whether it's a company that is wanting to, you know, bottle water from a spring that is important to a tribe. There's a long history of tribes fighting government and fighting big corporations in similar instances.
Amy Sisk is a reporter with the Inside Energy Public Media Collaboration and Prairie Public Broadcasting. She spoke to us from Bismarck, North Dakota. Thank you so much, Amy.
Thank you.
More troubles in Native lands. The death of pregnant 23-year-old Renee Davis, shot and killed by police last Friday on the Muckleshoot tribal land in Washington state, seems to be a case where a young mother's mental illness was more than the cops could handle. On a so-called wellness visit to check up on Davis and her two kids after reports of an armed woman, cops confronted her and Davis was reportedly shot and killed. Per capita in the United States, Native Americans are more likely to be killed by police than any other group, including African Americans. And that one in four people are killed by cops have also threatened suicide and experienced other mental health issues. Family and friends have responded to the Davis case by bringing attention to it using the hashtag Native Lives Matter. The facts in this case remain to be confirmed, but it's another example of how mental illness and the lack of services have left law enforcement to be a very unsatisfactory option in Native American communities where poverty and mental illness are prevalent. Joining me now is Simon Moya Smith, a citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation. He's culture editor for Indian Country Today. Simon, welcome.
How's it going?
What do you think is the chance that this killing, this shooting in Washington State will become a cause celeb? The hashtag Native Lives Matter, of course, coming out of the circumstances which are very concerning about this death of Ms. Davis. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the Native Lives Matter, first off, that obviously is an offshoot of Black Lives Matter, and that's been around actually for a couple of years. It really hasn't, you know, picked up steam in the same way. Again, Native Americans are a small racial minority within the United States, so we don't have the same numbers as say, the Black community to galvanize, like, a movement. But with regard to Renee Davis, I think people need to understand that she was a mother of three, and that she was 5 months pregnant when she was shot and killed. And we need to examine thoroughly across this country how police respond to people who are suffering from psychological conditions. It's imperative that we prepare them to approach somebody who is in a gentle state. She did not deserve to die. All she needed was help. She didn't need to be killed.
And would you say that the issue of mental illness further compounds an already tense situation between cops and Native people, or it is the whole problem?
There is a sense of distrust with police because at this point, you don't even want to call a cop. Because if your family member is suffering from depression or they're suffering from an episode, don't call the cops because your family member may not make it through the night.
And are cops typically members of the community or typically not members of the community?
That all depends, right? Because 70% of Native Americans now live in big cities. So on reservations, you can have reservation police. But off reservations, you have non-Indian police. So in a case with Mahavis Goodblanket, he was a young Cheyenne Arapaho 18-year-old boy off his reservation, living outside of the reservation boundaries, and he was shot 7 times by Custer County sheriffs, once in the back of the head. And both of those sheriffs received Medals of Valor. So now, not only are they killing Native Americans, they're awarding Native Americans. We can't get indictments because they're awarding each other for killing Indians.
What mental health services are available to deal with the traumas that you described, some of which are cross-generational?
Very little, because funds are little. We continually ask for help. We're saying, that, look, people like to say, well, one kid came to me once and he says, you know what, Simon, I don't like the fact that people, when people see a drunk white man, they say, well, he's hitting on, you know, hard times. But when it's a Native American, they say that's just who they are. And so people think that this is just who we are. It's not who we are. We do suffer from trauma. We do suffer the plague of suicides in Indian country. And really quickly, just to give you an idea of what's going on, last night the Cleveland Indians were playing and you saw red face everywhere. Well, mascots have been proven to harm the mental health and stability of kids. And that can lead to depression, to these situations where kids may feel suicidal. Then they got to call the cops. It's a cycle.
Given that the Redskins case is in district court and that, as you say, the history of Native Americans as a form of ethnic cleansing to establish the new nation, the United States, is now something that's suddenly in the conversation, as a lot of racial history is in the conversation. And you've got this, for the first time in 40 years, tribal consensus on fighting this Dakota Access Pipeline. Mm-hmm. Is this a moment for the broader America to re-examine some of the issues that you describe?
Yeah, of course. But I think people need to understand that our resistance, our opposition to dehumanization, whether that be in the form of mascots or pipelines coming through, they need to understand that social media is new, not our resistance. We have been fighting against the dehumanization, against the persecution of indigenous peoples since the first white man got here. And the thing that people need to recognize about the Dakota Access Pipeline is the pipeline are saying that the natives, the indigenous people of this land, are trespassing on that land. No, they're trespassing on our land, treaty-protected land. Fort Laramie Treaty of 1851 said no white man will be allowed here. We've stolen billions of your land. This is yours. So they're selling land that is not theirs to sell. And everybody, you, John, me, we have a right to our land, to protect our land, to protect our kids, to protect our water, whether it's from pipelines or police.
Does the fact that the Obama administration supports the claim of the Sioux in North Dakota indicate a possible victory in shutting down the pipeline, or just a temporary halt in this?
So far, it's only been temporary. We need him to actually stop it. We need him to step in and stop it. And we also need somebody like Hillary Clinton, who claims to be Native American. Bill Clinton also claims to be Native American. We need them to step up and stop this. We need them to recognize Native Americans. There were three presidential debates plus one VP debate and no mention of Native Americans when it came to racism or institutional racism in policing. They didn't mention anything.
Simon, what's your response to the report in The Guardian that Donald Trump is a big investor in Energy Transfer Partners, the pipeline company, and that company has given hundreds of thousands of dollars to his campaign?
Well, that's not surprising, right? And then also that doesn't bode well for Indian country should he be elected to president.
Simon Moya Smith is a citizen of the Oglala Lakota Nation and culture editor for Indian Country Today. Thanks so much, Simon.
Thank you.
Airbnb, the website that turns your home into a hotel or a short-term rental and has disrupted the all-powerful New York City real estate business, is suing New York State over a new law that imposes big fines on any host who violates a 2010 New York State law. Landlords and tenants cannot rent apartments for less than 30 days in New York. Critics of short-term rentals say they restrict the rental market and drive up housing prices. But hosts in New York City brought in a total of $1 billion last year for Airbnb, the most of any city in the U.S. Losing New York could hurt, especially as other cities ponder their own regulations aimed at the sharing industry, where Airbnb is the big gorilla. Nancy Leong is an associate professor at University of Denver School of Law who studies the sharing economy. She says right now it's a mystery as to who will blink first.
We are really in uncharted territory here. One thing that Airbnb seems to think is very important is a statute called the Communications Decency Act. Now, it's important to keep in mind that this law was originally designed to protect websites from being liable for the content that their users post. So, for example, if somebody libels someone else on Facebook or on Reddit, it seems unfair to sue the website owner. And Airbnb is saying that this statute applies here so that it can't be liable in this situation either. But it seems to me that one might argue that a difference with Airbnb is that the company is actually participating in creating the content. So there's a specific design to the website. It creates spaces for people to make profiles with very clear and detailed instructions about how people should go about filling out their profile. So this is not a situation where the website is just passively receiving content from third parties. It's a situation where Airbnb is actually participating in creating the content itself.
Well, it's also the case that there is a law against renting apartments for less than 30 days in the city of New York, and Airbnb would have the option of not doing business in New York for that reason, or putting a big restriction on the New York market for Airbnb. But instead, it's just kind of, you know, looking the other way and allowing people online to sublet their apartments for short terms that is very disruptive to the market, at least in the view of people who are criticizing what Airbnb is doing.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this new law allows authorities to fine hosts up to $7,500 if they're caught listing a short-term rental property on Airbnb or a similar platform. And Airbnb is concerned about this because New York is its biggest market. It's, I think, about $1 billion in revenue just last year. And so obviously it doesn't want to have to police every single person who rents an apartment on the website, which is what the law would possibly require it to do.
Well, cities view apartments as territory that are within their borders and that they clearly have jurisdiction over. Something like Airbnb views apartments as offers. They're more like data points. They don't represent territory. And so it seems that the view of, I mean, are the views of apartments by something like Airbnb and the view of city property by a municipal organization incompatible?
I do think that they see their role here as very different. So the city is saying, look, Airbnb is helping to make these short-term rentals available. And so it's essentially performing the same function in the housing market as a hotel. I think Airbnb sees itself differently. It sees itself as just connecting people who have properties they'd like to make available with people who would like to rent those properties out for a few nights. So it sees itself as facilitating this transaction, but not the way that a hotel does, actually offering the room up for rent.
Where is the regulatory environment likely to break for Airbnb? What will be the first real change in the Airbnb business, which has up till now been pretty free?
So I think we're going to start seeing this type of law more and more across the country, because Airbnb has created a situation where when people convert their properties into short-term rentals, there are fewer long-term rentals available, and that has driven prices up dramatically in a lot of neighborhoods. So people who actually live in cities like New York are not happy about this situation. What regulators, I think, will start to do is to ask Airbnb to do a better job of policing the properties that are listed on its website itself, so that there aren't these violations of the short-term housing laws.
At the end of this whole shakeout, will Airbnb be still the dominant business in this short-term rental online space, or will they be overtaken by someone else? I mean, it's really the Uber moment for Airbnb.
Yeah, it really is the Uber moment for Airbnb. And, you know, this is a huge company. It's tripled in value in just the past 2 years to something like, I think it's currently valued at around $30 billion. So this is the major player in the short-term housing market. You know, I mean, they're competing with the very largest hotel chains in the world. But, you know, as cities are beginning to regulate businesses like Airbnb and, you know, to a lesser extent, the smaller participants in this market like HomeAway and VRBO, I do think that Airbnb will have to potentially reassess exactly what its role is going to be. But I do think that regulations will mean that it can't just operate in this completely unregulated space the way it has been in many locations.
Nancy Leong is an associate professor at University of Denver School of Law who studies the sharing economy. Nancy, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
High fly ball into left at the wall. Goodbye. 6-0 Indians.
Cleveland defeated Chicago 6-0 in the first game of the World Series last night. Yesterday, we glimpsed the Chicago Cubs' last moment of real baseball glory in 1908. As we look in on the story of Cleveland in 1948, when the team last won the series, the city was long past its oil boom days. The Rockefellers had all moved east to dominate energy and finance. The Cleveland left behind was at the center of America's second great wave of prosperity, the war boom.
You had prosperity from the war industries. You had success with the Indians. You had a large population that made it sixth largest in the country, something that was actually a point of pride that they were the sixth city in the U.S. at that point. And it was a time when, you know, there was stores downtown and traffic downtown and people all over the place.
Historian Stephanie Licio is a doctoral candidate at Case Western Reserve University. She says that Cleveland was one of the first northern industrial cities to face up to America's racial future. And it projected that future through the window of baseball.
In 1947, the Indians were the first team in the American League to integrate. The Dodgers had done so with Jackie Robinson just 11 weeks earlier. That was April 15th of 1947, and the Indians signed Larry Doby on July 5th, 1947. And he didn't play a lot in 1947, but by 1948, he was a regular. And then in 1948, the other big signing was to get Satchel Paige, who was a legendary Negro League pitcher, probably one of the greatest pitchers that ever lived, who at that point was 42, sort of in the twilight of his career.
Satchel Paige and Larry Doby were bona fide stars back in the 40s. The legendary Cleveland Buckeyes Negro League team had its own fans, but the integrated 1948 Indians became the team for all Clevelanders sharing the post-war wealth. Owner Bill Veeck could see that integration was the nation's future.
So you do have more people starting to go. The integrated crowd is drawing a more mixed group of fans, and that was probably by design because Bill Veeck and Branch Rickey both knew that this was an area that could be tapped in to bring in more fans to your team.
When the Indians made it to the series, a whole nation would see a city united and its racial divisions slipping into the past.
So they set attendance records in 48, and so you have these massive crowds of 80,000 people in this gigantic stadium watching the World Series games here in Cleveland.
Around comes the right arm, the pitch, an overhand fastball swung on, hit high and deep in the right center field. The ball is going, going, it is gone! Larry Doby just teed off for the first home run of the 1948 World Series.
In the locker room, there's a picture that was taken between Larry Doby and that game's starter, Steve Gromek, where they're hugging each other. And that was sort of a huge deal in 1948 to have on the front page of a newspaper a white player and a black player hugging.
The great irony of Cleveland's baseball racial success is that it was built on a race and identity swept away. The Indians' name dates back to 1915, as U.S. Army forces were still engaged in a war with Western tribes. The Indians' mascot, Chief Wahoo, is a cruel and much later caricature of those times.
It was a time where people didn't acknowledge that this isn't probably something that's a good thing. In fact, if you've seen drawings of the original Wahoo, which I think was sketched out in 1946, I think it's later, these questions are, geez, look at this thing. should we really keep this? But it's managed to hang on until now.
Just as the future of the Washington Redskins' name is now a federal court case, these Indians may eventually be on a similar collision course with history. The Cleveland left behind from those days became a junkyard for old dreams, where the thought of winning again seems as silly as the idea of clean air or an economic comeback.
it's sort of shocking when they do well. You know, it's sort of like you don't expect that. I guess you become adjusted to being disappointed.
So that 6-0 win last night was the good kind of shock, just like the NBA champions were this spring. Could Cleveland be Title City?
It still sort of blows my mind a little bit, kind of waiting to wake up. Like, this can't be really happening, can it?
Cleveland's baseball dream, with all its irony and history, continues tonight with Game 2.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card, delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Is the Congress in play, the Senate and House of Representatives? Could they switch parties? We've been focusing on races around the country where Republican incumbents are fighting to hold on to their seats. In Nevada, it's the retirement of Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid, which has produced a very tight three-way race. Three-term Republican candidate Congressman Joe Heck is balancing his recent decision to withdraw support from his Republican presidential candidate, Mr. Trump, without alienating his base. His opponent, Democrat Catherine Cortez Masto, previously served as Attorney General of Nevada, would be the first ever Latina to serve in the Senate if elected. Joe Shaneman is host and senior producer of KNPR's State of Nevada. Welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi.
So this is a really tight race, and Reid doesn't have any coattails here. His departure leaves it completely open, or Nevada is a Republican state last time I checked?
Nevada is kind of a purple state right now. The major cities, the Reno area in Las Vegas, are really heavily Democratic, and they are the major population centers. And right now, for the first time in several months, Catherine Cortez Masto is leading in the latest polls by 2 points over Heck, which is within the margin of error. So it could go either way. But this is the first time she's ever led. And Reid might be leaving, but he has what's called the Reid machine here in full force. And that is basically he being the puppet master over the money and the machinations of the political machinery here in Nevada. And he's trying very hard to get Catherine Cortez Masto elected.
And that's alive and well. That whole machine is alive and well, even as the GOP is in disarray because of the Trump phenomenon.
It is. And there's a lot of and Heck has put himself sort of in the middle of that disarray when after the Access Hollywood video came out, Heck had a rally where he said that he was sort of disavowing Trump and wanted him to pull out. He was booed at this rally. Now there's speculation that people who might have supported him because of his support for Trump won't come out and vote. And that might have put her ahead. Meanwhile, both are spending money, you know, like drunken sailors.
Oh, yeah.
Cortez Masto has spent some $5.5 million by mid-September. PACs, outside PACs, have spent about $10 million on her behalf. The numbers are roughly the same for Heck. The total money spent is $25 million. By the time the election is over, they expect it to be $50 million, which is sort of on par of what was spent 6 years ago.
Does Mitch McConnell have a machine that can help Heck?
Mitch McConnell is part, or there's a super PAC supported by Mitch McConnell that is pouring money into Heck's campaign. So that's a connection. They really want him to win here. This is the key state, they believe, for control of the U.S. Senate.
And what about what's going on next door in the state of Utah? Does Evan McMullen have any sort of crossover interest in the sizably Mormon state of Nevada?
The crossover there really isn't so strong. People here there is a Mormon contingent, obviously, in Nevada. Basically, the city of Las Vegas was founded by Mormons. But it's an extremely diverse community these days. I mean, with some 2.2 million people, roughly a quarter of those people are from here. Almost everybody here is an immigrant from a different state or a different country. So it plays less of a part.
And you want to call this race? What do you think, with 2 weeks out?
Boy, it is too close to call. The attack ads make both candidates seem like demons in certain ways. So it all depends. If people are paying attention, if they're doing their research, It's going to be very, very close.
Joe Shaneman is in the vortex in Nevada there. He's host and senior producer of KNPR's State of Nevada. Thanks so much, Joe.
You're welcome.
For the rest of this hour, a look at the ambitious spirit of today's America, as well as a deeper look at just how wildly ambitious the founders of this country were in a time of radical change more than two centuries ago. But meet Joe DeSena, who came into this studio a while back carrying a 60-pound kettlebell. He looked like he could snap a 2x4 in one hand. He said he was carrying the weight because he was on too tight of a schedule to work out while in New York City. Staying in shape is his business after a stint on Wall Street and an early retirement to a farm in Vermont. But being insanely active on his farm, 12 hours of manual labor a day, pulling rocks up and down the mountain, and doing survival camps with his kids, gave him the inspiration to found the Spartan Race, where more than 4 million people participate in extreme obstacle courses globally, and Joe DeSena is now the CEO and founder of the Spartan Race Company. He's also the author of the book, Spartan Fit. His ambition is to start a global fitness movement to bring world peace, to make everything better. You'll hear him say it, and bring the race to the Summer Olympics in 2024. Think of him as a cross between Sisyphus and Gandhi.
This whole thing is based on stoicism and just getting back to basics. I think we've all gotten consumed, for lack of a better word, in consumerism, right? We're just chasing things, and even myself, all of us. So there's something very refreshing about just getting back to, I want water, food, shelter. And when you get there, it feels really good, right? Just not having your phone for a day feels really good.
No, that is true.
Yeah, and so this whole concept has its roots in that philosophy.
But in your life, I mean, you went up to Vermont, right? And that wasn't good enough. I mean, just hanging out in Vermont was not good enough. You had to go well beyond the basics of just hanging out in the mountains.
Chopping wood.
Yeah.
Vermont was awesome. I was lucky enough that my wife was up for it. We got a farm. We had goats, chickens, Scottish Highlanders. We grew 4 children. Our oldest is 10 now. And it's awesome, but no, it wasn't enough. And so it required carrying rocks up and down the mountain in the backyard and getting out in the woods, doing little survival camps with the kids. And it's so exciting, and it feels so good when you get involved in it that I started roping other people into it.
What would it mean for this to be an Olympic sport, and how would you have to codify it for it to make sense as an Olympic sport?
Well, so we've had a bunch of meetings with people that are very influential in that community, and it's going to be a long road, but it's doable. And the reason it's doable is we have a giant following, and they're the right demographic. And when you look at a lot of the Olympic sports, they're very small communities, 10,000 athletes, 15,000 athletes. We're reaching almost 1 million participants a year just under the Spartan brand. You're talking about 3.5-4 million when you look at all the brands putting on races in mud and outdoors and over obstacles. So it's a very big movement. And by the way, when you look way back at the Olympics, this is a sport that's supposed to be in the Olympics. There are components of this sport that have existed or currently exist in the Olympics.
Such as?
I mean, take a look at pentathlon as an example, right? And so So this has its place in the Olympics. It's just going to be getting through the red tape and bureaucracy of that Olympic committee.
So, and really getting through the exact hurdles that you talked about mentally here, the wanting medals, the wanting cell phones, the consumerism. I mean, in many ways, the Olympic movement needs to shed some of that consumerism to embrace something like this.
You know, it's funny when members came out and came to see our events and we had these discussions, many of our athletes compete without shirts on. And it looks very barbaric. I mean, it literally looks like Gladiator, right? People are dirty and they did comment on that, but we'll see how much we have to conform, how much they have to bend. But one way or another, before I'm dead, this will be an Olympic sport.
What has this meant for you spiritually? How are you different from the kid in Queens who, you know, would eat hot Italian sausage sandwiches in Crotona Park?
mozzarella and roasted peppers was my that was my sandwich. So coming from Queens, coming from Howard Beach, everybody was a hustler. John Gotti was everywhere, and that was the thing everybody wanted to be, right? So we chased you chased money, you know, fame, and you wanted respect. And thankfully, my mother finds this other way and introduces it to my sister and I, and that at least opens the door in my mind that there are other possibilities, that maybe that's not the thing that I should be chasing. But before you know it, I end up on Wall Street, and I take a path that all of us want to take, right? You want to get ahead monetarily. And then I got married and we got the farm. And you get the farm and you get away from, you know, the yellow taxi cabs and the craziness of Manhattan, and you start thinking, you know, maybe all that stuff I was chasing wasn't that important. Obviously, you want to have enough money to pay the bills and you want to get by, but does it really matter? You can't take it with you. We've all heard that. And it feels really good to be healthy, and it feels really good to push physical limits. And by the way, the mind sits inside of the body. So the better the body's feeling, the better the mind's operating. And I don't know. I mean, I just started living like a Spartan, right? You're out there in the cold, you're chopping wood, and it just felt really good.
And through this back door, you've got respect, money, and fame.
Yeah, I'm waiting for the money part, but we're able to open a lot of doors, and it's pretty nice. I mean, we're in 30 countries. I can go anywhere and get a meeting with anybody. That, I have to say, that's very nice. Money hasn't come yet, but you know what? As long as we could pay the bills and this movement keeps growing, I can't complain.
And you've been there before on the money world.
And I've been there before. And you know what? I did 10 years on Wall Street, and we had a really good run. And we made a lot of money, but man, life sucked. So, you know.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Joe DeSena is CEO and founder of the Spartan Race and author of Spartan Fit. Thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
What will historians make of this current period in American history in the midst of all the trivialities of the 2016 campaign? They may find a deeper movement to reclaim history and re-examine America's myths, everything from the Indian logo on a baseball cap to the notions of justice and freedom that get trotted out every 4 years and feel so unsatisfying in campaigns in which facts are disregarded and critical thinking is devalued. Carolyn Winterer is a professor of history at Stanford University who has looked back at the founders of America to re-examine just how radical they were and how much they challenged the thinking in Europe at the time. The so-called Enlightenment of the 18th century, she says, owes much to the American spirit. In her new book, American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason, Winterer writes about the period leading up to the Revolutionary War, a period of extreme radicalism and anything is possible experimentation that she says was driven by the sheer power of collective American curiosity.
They had no idea that they were crafting a mythical thing called the American Enlightenment. What I found instead was a lot of people who were asking a lot of questions about a very new thing, a new process that they called enlightenment with a small e. They wanted to become enlightened. Americans in the 18th century were not so much about declaring self-evident truths, but about asking how to make the world a better place, but never being sure whether they had hit upon the right way of doing that.
Hmm. How do you come to the conclusion, and it's really interesting, that the experience of America and people in the New World was very much a driver of the Enlightenment in Europe, and it wasn't the other way around, that the Europeans were teaching, you know, rationality to Americans and they were putting it into practice in the woods.
Right. So the New World really was a new world at this time. And there were a lot of things that were happening in the Americas that were new and exciting and different. And they wrote about those things constantly and feverishly and with great excitement to Europeans, explaining to them that this was the condition of the Americas. They knew a lot about American Indians. They knew a lot about American mountains and rivers and clouds and oceans and beaches. And all of these things were so exciting to them. And they wrote to Europe, and Europe listened. And so this is what is new in this book, as you're pointing out, is to say that the Americans were not just receiving ideas that Europeans had concocted in their own studies, and then using these to create wonderful things like the American Revolution. Of course, some of that happened, but Americans were also writing back to Europe and shipping all kinds of things, boxes of caterpillars and mosses and moose antlers and all of these exciting things from the Americas back to Europe. And Europeans were using them to reevaluate where they stood in the world as well. So I prefer to see the Atlantic as a great conversation, not just a one-way boat ride for European ideas to America, but a very long-term conversation between Europeans and Americans.
You write about these letters that you use as source material. How surprising was the level of intensity in these conversations that you use to depict this Atlantic conversation as you describe it?
Well, these letters are wonderful, and there are hundreds of thousands of them. You know, we're getting to this era now where some people, like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin, have 20,000 letters that they send and receive over the course of their lives. And what was wonderful about these letters is that you could try ideas out. You know, once you committed yourself to print, you were committed, right? You had said something and everybody was going to read it. But within the privacy of a letter, you could venture new ideas. And so when you read these letters, they're just all over the map. One single letter can talk about 15 different things. Greetings to your aunt. Let me tell you about my new stove that I am concocting, and I'm going to speculate about the chemistry of digestion. All of these things go in the space of one letter.
The open-mindedness of these letters, I think, leads me to the somber conclusion that comes, you know, later in your book, that this invention of the Cold War idea of an American Enlightenment to get us off the hook for World War II seems to me to become a kind of prison for America that gets recited over and over in our electoral rhetoric, saying we're the greatest nation on earth, that we're, you know, the land of freedom, and that it keeps us from seeing the things that we need to see in our own lives, lapses in our own society, conversations that we never had because of what the Cold War did. Is that how you think this all developed?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with that. The Cold War idea of a kind of sealed, totally sure American Enlightenment is an intellectual prison for us because it limits us to thinking about people in the 18th century, to thinking about them as kind of miniature versions of ourselves. And in fact, what we find when we go back there are models of open-ended inquiry, people who did not know a lot of things and who ended a lot of conversations with question marks rather than exclamation points. They wanted to know, and so they opened conversations with other people in other countries, in other languages, and they asked questions. You know, tell me, I do not know, what is the good society? What does it mean to create a just government? These are questions, and they are ones that Americans should continue to ask, and the 18th century gives us some models for how we can do that.
Do you wish the people running for president or in our political life were more inquisitive and less apparently confident about everything they say?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we shouldn't build walls between our own country and other countries. We should learn each other's languages and talk to each other. You know, we're all human beings, and that was one of the great commitments of the Enlightenment, was to embrace our common humanity and the fact that our fates were all tied. We were all humans, and we were all going to go down that road together. So we could either do it together or separately. And so I worry about a national posture of defensiveness and negativity toward people who live elsewhere. That was not what the Enlightenment was about.
Caroline Winterer is a professor of history at Stanford University and author of American Enlightenments, Pursuing Happiness in the Age of Reason. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
If you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program, check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.